thunderstorms, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. Now back to All Things Considered.
What do I tell 663,000 people when President Trump breaks his promise by pushing them off of Medicaid?
Senate Republicans are counting votes as the White House pressures lawmakers to pass a sweeping policy bill.
From Monday, June 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll recap a Supreme Court term that was good to President Trump and preview what's to come.
I think the justices are going to have a much busier and much more divisive summer than they're used to and, frankly, than I think they'll want.
Also, people who've lost the ability to move or speak may soon have a new option.
A surgically implanted device that links their brain to a computer.
With sensation, I could feel that the hand had made contact. I could also tell if I had a firm grip on it or not.
Plus, this week's unsung hero.
After this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Justice Department is now aggressively prioritizing efforts to strip naturalized U.S. citizens of their citizenship. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports the DOJ is focusing on cases where naturalized citizens commit certain crimes.
The new stance towards naturalized citizens who commit crimes is laid out in a memo from the Justice Department to its Civil Division employees. Those crimes could include anything from national security incidents to cases of fraud, according to the memo. According to 2023 data, 25 million immigrants are naturalized U.S. citizens. Denaturalization has existed for decades and was used widely to deport citizens accused of being communists during the 1950s. Some immigration attorneys have expressed concerns over this expanded denaturalization effort, questioning whether it is constitutional and how the families of naturalized citizens would be impacted. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Senate lawmakers are in a race to the finish line as they seek to wrap up work on President Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. Lawmakers taking part in a so-called voterama that's expected to go on into the evening. The White House says it's counting on Republican lawmakers to get the job done. That means Republicans in the Senate can only afford to lose three votes, with two GOP lawmakers, Rand Paul and Tom Tillis, already saying they're firm no's. Republicans in Congress are considering an even faster phase-out of tax credits for electric vehicles than they'd previously planned. That's according to the latest full version of the Senate's tax and spending bill. Here's NPR's Camila Domonoske.
The credits are worth up to $4,000 for used EVs or $7,500 for new vehicles. House Republicans voted to phase them out starting at the end of this year. But the Senate suggested a cutoff of September 30th, 3 months from now. One EV trade group called that a significant step backward that would help China. Republicans have called the tax credits wasteful. Auto dealers, meanwhile, are lobbying to keep the credits longer. Despite years of questioning the push toward EVs, the major dealer trade group now says ending credits abruptly would cause confusion and disruption. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Authorities in Idaho say the man they suspect of setting a fire, luring in firefighters, and then shooting and killing two and wounding another has been found dead in nearby mountains. They've identified the suspect as 20-year-old Wes Rowley of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Robert Norris is the Kootenai County Sheriff.
Rowley was found to be in possession of a flint starter, and we believe that was his method for starting the fire. That eventually led to firefighters responding.
As to what prompted the ambush and shootings, that remains unclear. Law enforcement officers exchanged fire with the gunman. Suspect was found by tracking cell phone signals. A rifle was found nearby. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street. The Dow's up 275 points. This is NPR. Canada's prime minister says his country is now rescinding a plan to tax U.S. technology firms. Prime Minister Mark Carney says trade talks with the U.S. have now resumed after they were suspended last week by President Trump. Trump had called the Canadian plan, which would have cost U.S. companies billions, a direct and blatant attack on our country. The tax deal was set to take effect Monday. The Museum of Broadcast Communications has announced this year's Radio Hall of Fame inductees. They include Alice Cooper, Martha Quinn, and a longtime NPR personality. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
This year's Radio Hall of Fame inductees include Shelley the Playboy Stewart, one of Birmingham, Alabama's most popular disc jockeys during the Civil Rights Movement, and nationally syndicated host Dee Dee McGuire.
If you couldn't get through on the phone lines, you still want to talk about it, please hit me up at Dee Dee in the morning.
Joining past NPR Hall of Famers like Bob Edwards and Susan Stamberg is Scott Simon.
Cup of tea and fresh cut grass. It's time for Wimbledon.
The 2025 Radio Hall of Fame inductees will be honored at a ceremony in Chicago in October. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
The AA team, the Erie Seawolves, are about to get a new name after a segment in May on John Oliver's show Last Week Tonight, where the comedian looked at names and the promotions of minor league ball clubs. He proposed a new name for the Erie, Pennsylvania team, the Erie Moon Mammoths. New name was apparently inspired by the 1991 discovery of the bone of a woolly mammoth in an area near the western Pennsylvania city. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Republican lawmakers are racing to pass President Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill before July 4th. One of several key obstacles dividing Republican senators is Medicaid, with hundreds of billions of dollars in potential cuts on the table.
What do I tell 663,000 people in 2 years or 3 years when President Trump breaks his promise by pushing them off of Medicaid?
That's Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, hours after announcing he would not seek re-election. Rural America is poised to be greatly impacted by these proposed cuts. Roughly 20% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas where Medicaid covers one in four adults. Here to talk about what could be at stake for those communities is Sarah Jane Tribble. She's the chief rural correspondent for KFF Health News. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Sarah, just start if you can by telling us a bit about what you have been hearing from people in rural communities across this country about these proposed cuts.
Yeah, I'm not hearing good things. They're very concerned because Medicaid rates are so high in rural America that these cuts will be very detrimental. They'll cause more hospitals to close. They'll tax rural health clinics. I was sitting next to a CEO of a rural hospital from Colorado. He has a 25-bed critical access hospital, the only hospital between the Kansas border and Denver on the Colorado I-70 corridor. And he'd been talking about the cuts and not happy about them. And then we heard about the Rural Transformation Fund that the Senate has been working on to sort of help offset the cuts. And he leaned over and he just scoffed. He just said, that's just not going to be enough. So I think that there's a lot of concern out there in rural America.
Hmm. Give us some details about some of the types of ways in which rural hospitals could be impacted. Like, I guess I'm trying to figure out how these cuts would work and what they would mean for patients.
Well, for rural hospitals, they're specifically already on the line. We've had more than 150 hospitals that have either closed completely or shut down their inpatient beds since 2010, according to UNC Shepps in North Carolina. Another 267 rural hospitals have closed their obstetrics units from 2011 to 2021. So these hospitals are already, you know, showing signs of duress underneath the current health system economics, if you will. And really, Congress has acknowledged this over the years, passing a new Rural Emergency Hospital Act a couple of years ago, trying to help shore up these hospitals.
Now, Senate Republicans have proposed adding a $25 billion fund for rural hospitals specifically. But Sarah, is that enough money to actually bridge the gap in funding that we're seeing here?
I'm hearing from the experts and organizations that it is absolutely not. The National Rural Health Association estimates that it's only 43% of what is needed for rural hospitals to offset the cuts coming in the Senate proposal. And even worse, that that Rural Transformation Fund won't just go to rural hospitals. It'll go to, you know, health clinics and federally qualified healthcare centers, community mental health and opioid treatment centers too, by their estimates. So they really don't think it's enough to offset it. I should note that I was talking to the chief lobbyist at the National Rural Health Association this morning. You know, they like the idea of a Rural Transformation Fund because rural America needs that. They need new ways of thinking about how to provide care in rural America, what kind of providers there should be. But it definitely doesn't offset the cuts coming to the program.
The White House put out a fact sheet yesterday making the point that the bill will not cut Medicaid. This fact sheet calls it a myth that the bill will close rural hospitals. How do you parse those claims?
Yeah, so when you talk to anybody from, say, Georgetown or some of the other experts out there, they have analyzed the numbers of who's using Medicaid in rural America, say moms, working age adults. These are patients of these hospitals. And if you decrease the number of people receiving Medicaid in rural areas, then you're going to decrease the amount of revenue the hospitals and clinics get because they just have less paying patients. But also there are some other provisions in the bill that experts have analyzed as far as work requirements and the provider taxes and state-directed payments. Those all do hit rural America in different ways, especially the expansion states. So, you know, as a reporter, when I'm parsing it, I call the experts and I ask them questions, and they tell me that it's going to hurt these hospitals in these rural communities.
Sarah, as you pointed out, rural hospitals have been on the decline for years, with many having closed in the last few decades, even more facing risk of immediate closure. I wonder, what does all of this mean for patients? I've heard about how these closures are particularly problematic, for example, for trauma care, cancer treatment.
Yeah. So I've done a lot of reporting over the years where I talk to patients who travel long distances for their care, right? I did a story out of New Mexico where they were setting up telehealth services after a hospital had closed its obstetrics units so patients wouldn't have to drive for every single prenatal visit, right? So those are situations that are already sort of on the brink, if you will, where patients are having to drive long distances when they're delivering babies, or even for trauma care, where helicopters have to show up and go significant distances to get people to care. And that's because rural hospitals have been closing, and rural care in general has been declining over the past couple of decades. There's a lot of places where there's just not enough providers in general. And when a rural hospital closes, providers tend to leave the area.
Sarah Jane Tribble is the chief rural correspondent for KFF Health News. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Zoran Mamdani was a young assemblyman in New York City just a year ago when few people had ever heard of him. But now, the 33-year-old Democratic socialist is in the running to become the city's next mayor. Mamdani talked to Morning Edition's Leila Fadel today and explained how he won the Democratic primary.
We sought especially to increase turnout amongst New Yorkers who hadn't been participating and to register new voters. And we said that we would do this by speaking directly to the crisis that working people were facing in this city, which is ultimately a crisis of affordability. Because no matter how many politicians try to make it about something else, what we see when we speak to New Yorkers, no matter where they live, no matter who they are, is that they are being pushed out of the city that they love because it's the most expensive city in the United States of America.
You know, typically the Democratic primary is seen as a done deal, right? Whoever wins this primary becomes the mayor of New York. But after your win, which really stunned a lot of people, the establishment of your party still hasn't really come behind you. What needs to happen for you to get them on side at this point? And why haven't they?
We have to earn support. We have to earn endorsements. And ultimately, it's been very exciting to see that we've received the endorsements of Congressman Nadler, of Senator Elizabeth Warren. We're seeing our coalition expand. And by building a tent around that affordability, we didn't just win places that were considered to be progressive. We won neighborhoods that voted for Donald Trump. And we did so because ultimately, you can actually win people back if you offer them a vision to vote for, not just something to vote against.
But there are leaders in your party who have been asked directly, Senator Chuck Schumer, Representative Hakeem Jeffries, both from New York, who were asked directly and still didn't endorse you. So what needs to happen for them to come on side? Have you met with them?
I'm looking forward to sitting down with both of them, because ultimately what we see in this primary election is an example of how we can also start to unite our party and build our party such that we can take on and defeat this right-wing authoritarianism we're seeing in Washington, D.C.
And you can hear the full interview tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Karen DeBoer. 35 years ago, when DeBoer was a freshman in college, she was accepted into her school's prestigious choir program. That year, they were traveling to China and Japan for an international tour, and she was looking forward to it. One of the choir's first performances was at a church about an hour away from campus, but the morning of the show, she woke up late and realized that she had missed the bus.
And I was like, this is the end of everything, because what if they say, well, you're not mature enough to be in this group? Then the international tour was out, and I was just afraid that my mistake had ruined it. And this is before cell phones, I can't call anybody, so I just kind of wandered out into the hallway in my dorm room, kind of whimpering, and that's probably why my roommate across the hall came out to see what was up. Her name was Pam, and our relationship was a bit prickly, and a lot of that was on me, because I had just gotten to college. I had freshman friends, and we were out on our own for the first time, and we were having fun. So we would run up and down the halls, we would knock on doors and run away, but we made a lot of noise, and we didn't particularly think about how that affected others on the same floor. Pam would come to us and ask us to be quiet because she was trying to study, or because she was trying to sleep. So Pam was the one that I saw across the hall when this happened. I told her my whole tale of how I'd messed up and I couldn't get to the concert. So she told me, well, I have a car here at college, and I know where that church is, so I could drive you there, which to me was shocking. She had no reason to be kind to me when I had not been kind to her. But she extended that to me, and we jumped into her car. It was about an hour away, and she drove me there the whole way. It was a gift of more than just her time or the ride itself. But it was a gift of forgiveness, really. Forgiving me for not being nice to her. So I want to say thank you. Because that decision that you made, when perhaps I didn't deserve that sort of kindness, and you decided to extend it anyway, that has had ripple effects through the next 30 years of my life.
Karen DeBoer lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Since college, DeBoer has continued her passion for music. She has sung in many professional choirs and now conducts a local community choir. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news, connection to community, and great music. Free to everyone with no paywall. Public radio stations play a critical role in getting timely, accurate emergency information to the public, especially in rural and underserved areas. Proposed cuts will hurt rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress, protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. It's Big Truck Day at the Virginia Public Library Thursday, July 10th from 10:30 to noon. See big machines and the vehicles that help keep our community safe. Fifth Avenue will be blocked off in front of the library for this event. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, July 10th at noon. This month, Dr. Daniel Larkin will talk about the invasive starry stonewort. Heartland Arts presents the Northwind Clarinets Thursday, July 10th at 12:15 at Calvary Lutheran Church in Park Rapids. They'll play a variety of genres on many different sized clarinets. And listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio, amplifying female voices in music with host Carmel Holt. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. People who have lost the ability to move or speak may soon have a new option, a surgically implanted device that links their brain to a computer.
Imagine the joy of connecting with your loved ones, browsing the web, or even playing games using only your thoughts.
That clip comes from Elon Musk's company Neuralink. It's the most visible player in the field of brain-computer interfaces. But NPR's John Hamilton reports that groups with less fame and more experience appear closer to actually marketing a device.
Neuralink went viral in early 2024 thanks to a man named Nolan Arbaugh. A diving accident had paralyzed him from the shoulders down. At 29, Arbaugh became the first person to get a Neuralink device. A robot threaded more than 1,000 electrodes into his brain's motor cortex. Then, human surgeons installed a wireless interface about the size of a quarter in his skull. A few weeks later, Arbaugh was on stage, talking about moving a computer cursor.
It's freaking wild. When I first moved it just by thinking, it blew my mind for like a day. Like, I just could not wrap my head around it.
A video of Arbaugh has attracted more than 25 million views on Musk's social media platform, X. But the success was tempered by news that some of the electrodes in Arbaugh's brain had moved, making the device less sensitive. Since then, Neuralink has implanted its device in six other people, but details are scant and the company didn't respond to requests for an interview. Brain scientists note that while Neuralink's surgical robots and wireless electronics are new, using thoughts to move a cursor isn't. Dr. Lee Hochberg of Brown University and Massachusetts General Hospital was part of a team that pioneered the approach decades ago.
So June of 2004 was our first incredible participant in the study.
That participant was Matt Nagel, a man who was living with paralysis after being stabbed in the neck. Hochberg's team linked Nagel's brain to a computer using old-fashioned wires that passed through his skull. A video shows him working with Abe Kaplan, a researcher.
What do you want to do first?
I'm going to open my email first.
Okay.
Then open the first one.
You're going to open the first one.
Hochberg says the device Nagel used, called BrainGate, showed the technology's potential.
Moving that cursor on the screen just by thinking about the movement of his own hand, it was exactly what was supposed to happen. And even for all of us that were expecting it, there was a little bit of magic there.
Nagel died in 2007 of an infection unrelated to the experiment. BrainGate evolved into an academic consortium directed by Hochberg. And this year, a study showed that a BrainGate 2 device had allowed a man with ALS to speak through a computer.
I am good.
Hochberg says experiments like that one show how computer interfaces have improved. They now monitor many more neurons in more areas of the brain. And Hochberg says scientists keep finding better answers to a critical question.
How do we decode that neural activity more accurately and more consistently and more reliably?
Today, that means using artificial intelligence to recognize the neural activity associated with a person's intention to speak or pick up a bar of chocolate. Hochberg says the field has also become specialized.
There are groups that are focused on decoding speech. There are groups that are focused on control of a computer cursor, or control of a tablet computer for that type of communication. There are groups that are focused on putting some information back into the brain.
One of the groups making information flow both ways is at the University of Pittsburgh. Jen Collinger, a professor there, says it isn't enough to just give people control of a prosthetic arm. They also need to feel what the limb is doing or touching.
You can't have sort of fine and dexterous motor control with visual feedback alone. You need that sense of touch in order to actually be able to respond in a natural way.
So Collinger and her colleagues have been working with BlackRock Neurotech, whose brain interface technology has been used in dozens of people. One of them is Nathan Copeland, who was paralyzed in a car accident. In 2016, Copeland famously used a robotic arm to bump fists with President Barack Obama.
Boom. Yeah. Blow it up.
In 2021, Copeland was part of a study that showed how much a sense of touch improved his ability to grasp objects with his prosthetic hand.
With sensation, I could feel that the hand had made contact. I could also tell if I had a firm grip on it or not.
But Collinger says advanced features like sensory feedback aren't going to appear in the first implanted devices on the market. She says companies like BlackRock, Neuralink, Synchron, and Paradromics are testing devices that provide control of a computer cursor, much like BrainGate did more than 20 years ago.
There's been enough progress and enough sort of consistent success in these early academic trials that now companies are saying, okay, we can offer a first-generation device to people that will provide some benefit.
One of those companies is Precision Neuroscience. It was co-founded by a neurosurgeon and engineer who had previously helped start Neuralink. Precision's other co-founder is Michael Mager, the CEO. He says the company's immediate goal is a wireless device that allows a person with paralysis to easily operate a smartphone or computer.
We think about accessing news and entertainment. We think about productivity software like Microsoft Office, you know, Word, PowerPoint, Excel. If you can operate those programs as well as someone who is sort of able-bodied, it's quality of life enhancing, and it's also potentially enabling for people to go back to work.
Mager says Precision's device differs from Neuralink's because it doesn't insert its electrodes into the brain.
We have a very, very thin film that is designed to sit on the surface of the brain without penetrating into or damaging the brain.
Mager says that makes the implant safer and less invasive, which could make it easier to get approval from the Food and Drug Administration. Another company, Synchron, avoids opening the skull entirely. Its electrodes are pushed through blood vessels using technology designed to place stents in blocked arteries. Mager says all of these devices face some common challenges.
We're sampling from thousands of electrodes, thousands of times a second. And the amount of data that comes off of these systems as a result is just enormous.
Far too much to transmit through a wireless link. So companies are working on ways to reduce or compress the data. Another obstacle is the cost to conduct the sort of clinical trials required by the FDA. That will probably be hundreds of millions of dollars. Even so, Mager says, his company and several others, including Neuralink, appear to have the money and expertise to turn the brain interface concept into a marketable product.
We know it works. We know the enabling technologies that are required are now ready. And it's time to turn this academic work into a thriving industry that can make a big impact on people's lives.
Mager says that won't take another 20 years, more like two or three. And the industry is going global. Just a few weeks ago, researchers in China posted a video of a man using their first brain-computer interface. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. Information about this summer's Martini Monday music series is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News,
I'm Danny Frere with the Up North Report. One person has died in a car crash Friday evening about 10 miles south of Aiken. 34-year-old Maggie Spichala suffered fatal injuries. She was driving an SUV with 39-year-old Patrick Spichala and five children ages 3 to 17 who all suffered non-life-threatening injuries. 18-year-olds Jimmy Dono and Cole Besmith were in a pickup truck and suffered non-life-threatening injuries. The family was headed north with the Fish House on Highway 169. Dono and Desmith were traveling east on Tame Fish Lake Road when the vehicles collided. All involved are from Hazleton Township, where the crash took place. The Aiken Independent Age reports there is a GoFundMe set up to help the family with funeral and burial costs. Hundreds of nurses across northeastern Minnesota and the Braden Lakes area could strike next week. Megan Buffington has the story.
Over 400 Essentia Health advanced practice providers from nearly 70 facilities filed a 10-day strike notice Monday. They authorized an unfair labor practices strike last week. APPs include nurse practitioners and physician assistants. The bargaining unit voted to join the Minnesota Nurses Association last year. MNA says Essentia is violating federal labor law by refusing to begin negotiations for a first contract. Essentia is challenging the bargaining unit's certification, arguing hospital and clinic staff should be in separate units. Nearly half of all patient encounters and a majority of urgent care encounters are with APPs, according to Essentia. The provider says a strike could put patient care at risk. Erin Swanson is a nurse practitioner in Baxter and part of the APP's negotiating team. She says they're very mindful of the impact a strike could have. That's why they waited nearly a year to call for one.
No one wants to strike, right? Like, we all go into healthcare to take care of our patients. It's very stressful. My hope is that Essentia doesn't let it happen.
Essentia says it's exercising its legal right to review, and a strike will not speed up that process. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Governor Tim Walz declared a peacetime emergency on Friday following the severe storm that caused widespread damage in Beltrami County. Larissa Donovan in Bemidji has more.
The governor also directed state agencies to provide additional assistance to support recovery efforts. The emergency order allows for continued support to emergency responders in affected communities. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management will continue coordinating on-site support for local government, and relevant state agencies will provide additional necessary assistance. Around the hard-hit city of Bemidji, crews have been hauling away tree debris from the storm. City Public Works Director Sam Anderson says the trees are being processed on site with a great big wood chipper.
And then that contractor is actually hauling it away. So we're creating capacity as we go. And so as far as the overall volume, I think we have a plan in place for that. But that could be something that comes up on a bigger scale as other facilities are starting to fill up. And that's still the unknown of how much really is there going to have to be.
A storm cleanup will likely take months, if not years. Anderson says crews will be around multiple times to help residents with their cleanup.
We're doing, at least right now, the first round on our city streets. We do anticipate a second, maybe even a third. We're still trying to get a scope and scale. There's people that are having struggles even pushing what they have to the street because of how much volume they do have.
Volunteers with the American Red Cross were expected to begin damage assessments around the storm-impacted areas of the Western Leech Lake Reservation on Monday. American Red Cross and Salvation Army will provide resources at the former First National Bank building in downtown Bemidji through Wednesday. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
The last day to comment on the draft report about the Big Fork River watershed is July 2nd. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency report identifies strategies to improve water quality conditions in Island Lake, Shallow Pond, Jesse Lake, and Little Spring. It also identifies potential issues such as excess nutrients in Round Lake, Dunbar Lake, and Bowstring Lake in the Leech Lake Reservation. You can find the link to submit a comment on our website, kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Danny Frere, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. It was a good year for President Trump at the Supreme Court. With decisions from executive power to deportation authority, the conservative supermajority sided with him most of the time. And in doing so, the court continued to dramatically reduce checks on the executive branch. To look back on the term that just wrapped up, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here, along with Steve Vladek of Georgetown University Law Center and Sarah Isker of SCOTUS Blog. Good to have you all here.
We're happy to be here.
Thanks for having us, Ari.
Yes.
What made it such a good year for President Trump? Nina, why don't you go first?
The court essentially stripped the lower courts of some of their most important powers at the same time that it gave itself enormous power in the vast majority of cases, ruling against the lower courts, which let the administration do what it wanted. What's more, Trump, for now at least, succeeded in changing the very nature of the court's work, because the court produced 56 opinions this term. That's the lowest number since the 1930s. And dating myself, when I first started covering the court, they had about 140 cases a year.
Wow.
But the bulk of the work, I think, was the so-called shadow docket, what's formerly known as the emergency docket, and used to be primarily for last-minute death penalty appeals or last-minute election cases that came up. Well, guess what? The death penalty appeals are still there, but they almost always lose, while the Trump emergency appeals almost always win. And there are many more of those, most of them decided without briefing and arguments and without any written opinion and without definitively knowing who voted how.
Interesting. Steve, you wrote a book about this called The Shadow Docket. Do you think Nina's right that the nature of the court's work has transformed?
There's no question, Ari, and I think it's really, really driven home this term, not just by the numbers of cases, but also by the impacts. I mean, we've already seen the Supreme Court have 14 different high-profile emergency applications involving Trump administration policies since April alone. I mean, that's just in the last, 3 months.
And this is everything from immigration to government worker layoffs to birthright citizenship and more.
That's exactly right. And to President Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. And what's striking about all of these cases is Nina's right. The court is almost never writing opinions in these cases, so that whether it's granting relief to the president, which is the norm, or in a couple of those Alien Enemies Act cases, granting relief to the detainees, it's not making a lot of law. And so it's massively impactful from the perspective of letting the administration continue to carry out initiatives that many think are lawless, while not necessarily settling the legality one way or the other, while preserving the justice's power at some, unknown future point, if they want to step back in and say, actually, this policy, this program, this firing was illegal.
Sarah, this is a 6-3 court with a conservative supermajority. Three of those justices were appointed by President Trump in his first term. Did the votes consistently line up 6-3 in the major cases that you were watching?
No, this term more than even the previous terms since we had those three Trump appointees join the court felt much more like a 3-3-3 court. We had as many of the closely divided cases, so here the 5-4s and the 6-3, were decided with all of the liberals in dissent, as were cases with all of the liberals in the majority, 15% each time.
The court did decide some major cases this term, the usual way with briefings, opinions, dissents, concurrences. Let me ask each of you for one case that you think was especially important. Steve, you want to kick us off?
I mean, I think, the biggest case to me of the entire term is one that actually crosses over from the normal emergency applications procedure to oral argument. The one time the court took one of those applications and held argument, that was the birthright citizenship cases, where, I think what the Supreme Court did in ruling 6-3 that what the you know, Justice Barrett calls universal injunctions, that is to say, an injunction that bars the government from acting against anybody, are generally not available, really, I think, does, or at least could, kneecap the ability of lower courts to block a whole slew of Trump administration initiatives, at least unless we see the very Supreme Court that was willing to narrow that kind of relief in that case, you know, all of a sudden embrace other ways of blocking Trump policies on a nationwide basis.
Which we will quickly see, because the ACLU immediately filed a class action lawsuit nationwide on behalf of people affected by the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order.
And that's the tricky part, Ari, which is the most important case of the term. Just how big a deal it is actually very much remains to be seen.
Sarah, tell us about one case that jumped out to you as especially important this term.
So I'm going to cheat and not answer the question, because to me it wasn't one case, but it's the further fracturing of the court. You know, when Chief Justice Roberts initially came into his position in 2005, he said he wanted a court like John Marshall, speaking with one voice. But instead, we've seen this proliferation of concurrences and concurring in the judgment and dissenting in part, so much so that if you look at the longest opinions of the term, of the top five, only two of them were majority opinions.
Huh.
The others were dissents and concurrences. So we're really seeing, you know, what amounts to like nine different law firms almost at the court instead of a single court speaking with a single voice.
Are they getting along? Is there beef? Like, give us a, what's the soap opera story?
I don't think there's any question, Ari, that they're not getting along. And I think part of that's because one of the real themes of this term is that I think the stakes are higher. I mean, I realize that that's a very strange thing to say, you know, a couple of years after Dobbs and a couple of years after Bruin. But at least from the perspective of some of the Democratic appointees, this is a term that was, and I think will continue to be, all the way up to October when it formally ends, very much about whether and to what extent this court is willing to stand up to President Trump. And I think part of what we've seen in the dissenting opinions from the Democratic appointees, both in some of the cases that got plenary review and in some of these emergency applications, is increasing exasperation with their colleagues in the majority, not just about taking claimed procedural shortcuts and not just about, you know, avoiding anything on the merits, but about the kind of behavior and conduct by the president that these decisions are enabling. Basically, a charge by the Democratic appointees that this court is not ready for this moment, even as we're seeing lower courts, I think, do their best to stand up to President Trump. The Supreme Court keeps saying, wait, lower courts, you've got to slow down, without providing much of a coherent theory in exchange.
We've seen dissents that, and I'm paraphrasing, accuse the majority of being complicit in the erosion of American democracy.
Yeah,
in pretty stark terms.
That's pretty stark. And when you sit there many days a week during the argument period, what you really see is a court of people who I don't think are, shall we put it this way, overly fond of each other. And there's nobody with a really great sense of humor. I mean, Scalia's sense of humor would just sort of instantly diffuse things, and you could see it. Or he would outrage people and then diffuse it. And there's nobody like that. It's a kind of a, you know, I have this sense that there are a bunch of people on this court who wanted these jobs and still would take them again but are not enjoying them.
That's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, Georgetown Law Professor Steve Laddick, and SCOTUS blog editor Sarah Isker. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. Here's a real-life mystery for you. A small-town Texas librarian finds a musty old Bible and soon realizes that it's unlike any Bible she has ever seen. It's hundreds of years old and written in a familiar but dead language. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan picks up the story from here.
First off, the town is Burney, about 20 miles northwest of San Antonio. Founded by German immigrants in 1849, it has the oldest oompa band outside of Germany. But this upscale town's library also holds a rare Bible. There's a lot they know about the Bible, but it also holds a secret that no one's been able to crack: how it got there. Lisa McHugh knows the Bible well. She wrote her master's thesis on it.
It was a 1614 Low German Bible, that it was rare and that we had only one of seven copies in the world.
Low German was essentially the common man's German.
Low German, I think, was kind of considered to be maybe less sophisticated version of German. The High German essentially was what turned into what modern day German is.
The Bible is 12 and a half pounds and 4 inches thick. Imagine its journey, 6 to 8 weeks on a sailing ship, and then a week on horseback to Burney from Galveston. Finding its age was simple because publishing info is printed in the Bible itself. Hans Stern published it in 1614.
And in fact, the Hans Stern publishing house is still in operation today, or was at the time that I wrote my dissertation in 2012.
The Stern Publishing Company still prints Bibles in Lüneburg 411 years later. The significance of the 1614 Bible goes beyond its age, though. Most predecessors were printed in Latin. In a sense, printing this Bible in Low German was the first step that would eventually lead to reading for reasons other than religious ones.
The whole idea of having books that people read for pleasure, eventually you get there, but it all kind of starts with people making Bibles in the vernacular versus in Latin.
When found, Burney's Bible was in rough shape, so it was sent to an expert who repaired the cover and 20 of its first pages that were highly damaged. Here's Burney Public Library's Robin Stauber.
The Bible came back to the library. A case was created for it, and so it was on display from then on till recently when we sent it off to the University of North Texas to get digitized.
By early fall, it will be accessible in ways it's never been before.
They are meta tagging it, so they are developing code words and searchable items. And then once they put all that together, it will be online at the Portal to Texas History.
Another factor to consider, this isn't a Bible for personal contemplation. It's huge. Elisa McCune.
It would not be comfortable to sit with in your lap for a long time. It would probably have been displayed on like a lectern at a church, for example.
And that brings us to the name scrawled inside the cover.
It has the name Johann Schwerting. It also has a date of 1660, so that's really great.
1660 is almost 200 years before any Germans lived in Burney. So did the Schwertings bring it here?
I have done some digging, and I have not found any evidence of a member of the Schwerting family in Burney proper. It's very likely that it was brought over from Germany by a member of this family, but it could have been a daughter or somebody who ended up with a different last name.
We may never know who brought the Burney Bible here, but maybe its digitized contents accessible worldwide will open a portal that didn't exist in the misty past. For NPR News, I'm Jack Morgan in Burney, Texas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew Dezingle. After Dark is KAXE's new Saturday night program, after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host, DJ Ben Franklinstein, will be playing funk. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon@kaxe.org. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. The Minnesota DNR reminds boaters to stay safe while enjoying the water this season. Wear your life jacket and make sure children are wearing theirs. Stay sober, let others know where you are going, and be aware of the weather. The Brainerd Public Library now offers Memory Maker kits for checkout. These kits are specially designed for caregivers of those experiencing memory challenges. The materials are meant to spark conversation and provide positive interactions. Bemidji's JC's 81st Annual Water Carnival is July 2nd through the 6th. Fireworks are Wednesday, July 2nd at dusk, with the Grand Parade Sunday, July 6th at 1 p.m. Find a full schedule at BemidjiJCs.com. The Grand Rapids YMCA hosts a free Forever Well picnic for older adults Wednesday, July 2nd from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Loon Country Arts Building in Bemidji is closed due to storm damage, but they will hold a creative cafe Saturday, July 5th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Beltrami County History Center. Artist Kathy Sanders will help you create a patriotic tile trivet. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A federal investigation has found that Harvard University violated civil rights law by failing to protect Jewish students on campus. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports the finding puts the school at risk of losing additional government funding.
It is the latest in a battle between the Trump administration and the world's wealthiest university. A federal anti-Semitism task force sent a letter to the university on Monday saying Harvard has been, quote, deliberately indifferent and in some cases, quote, a willful participant in anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students, faculty, and staff. The investigation comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights. And its findings outline the violations that occurred on the Cambridge, Massachusetts campus since October 7th, 2023. The violations they cite include examples of Jewish and Israeli students being harassed, campus vandalism, and examples of the university failing to punish students and groups who violated codes of conduct. The report says its findings show a pattern of, quote, unlawful and unchecked discrimination at Harvard. In a statement, a Harvard spokesperson said the university is far from indifferent and strongly disagrees with the government's findings. The school pointed to a number of steps it has taken to better protect against anti-Semitism and support Jewish students on campus, including updating its campus rules, reviewing discipline policies, and expanding training on anti-Semitism across campus. Harvard has admitted it needs to work on this issue. Earlier this year, the school's own task force found many opportunities for improvement. That report was cited heavily in the Federal Review released today. But the report says Harvard has done too little, too late to remedy violations. And the next step is for the U.S. Department of Justice to take up the issue. Meanwhile, negotiations between the school and the Trump administration continue to avoid Harvard losing more federal funding. It already had more than $2 billion frozen and is currently suing the administration. A hearing for that trial is set for later in July. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Colombian singer Carol G has a new album out. It's called Tropicoqueta. The co-host of NPR's Alt-Latino podcast, Ana Maria Sayer, has been listening to it, and she says Carol G went for a sort of pan-Latin sound with this album. Here's Ana Maria in conversation with NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Traditionally, what it meant to be, quote, a pan-Latin artist or a big pop star in the Spanish language space, it was to kind of create this very, like, general pop Latin sound. And what she has tried to do on this record is to create, yes, a sound for all of Latin America, but by actually zeroing in track by track, song to song, in different geographical and musical traditions.
Let's shout out some tracks. Yeah, well, what do you got here for us?
We can look at this incredible track, Tropicoqueta, which is literally the title track of the album. La mano derecha en la cabeza, la otra mano en el ombliguito. Within the track itself goes from what is a mambo to a dembow to finally turning it into a merengue. I mean, it's explosive within the track itself. If you look at Ese Hombre Es Malo, that's a beautiful, very traditional Mexican, like, época de oro, big sound. Es que ese hombre es malo, es mentiroso, es posesivo. Se veía tan convencido de querer estar conmigo. Latin America is really becoming very obsessed and also celebratory of its traditional sounds. What she's doing is actually going to Cuba. She's going to Puerto Rico. She's going to the Dominican Republic. She's going to Mexico. She's not just using Colombian traditional sounds. And I think the question a lot of people are going to ask is she capitalizing on that or paying homage to it?
As she's bouncing around between these different musical traditions, you know, she's been the subject of some criticism for, let's call it, like, cultural appropriation in the past, right? Does that come up with this record?
I think it's definitely going to be a conversation. And when we talk about the question of appropriating in music, it's a tricky one, right? Because music is music. Inherently, yeah. You know, something that always comes from something else. I think the better question is often to ask whether it's fully capitalizing on something that is not yours, or it's something that feels maybe a little bit inauthentic to you. I think the question of authenticity is an interesting one. She did say that during her experience touring her last record, she did feel this experience, right, of seeing how people would look at her from all different parts of Latin America and say, wow, you feel like a piece of home for me. And she really wanted to embody that. She wanted to embody being that unifying figure. As people from Latin America, from all parts of Latin America, were really excited about each other's music right now, each other's traditional music, I think that's the more important sentiment to me.
So, Ana Maria, if we want to go out on one song that kind of sums up this album, what do you think we should go out on?
Okay, so Brazil is like its own little island in Latin America. They have these massive superstars, and they listen to their own music, and they promote their music. It's like its own self-sustaining cultural system. And she started her song, Bandida Entrenada, with Portuguese. Diz que sou malvada, sou atrevida. Invado tua base, roubo tua paz, bagunço tua vida. Quando cai a madrugada, a lua me enxiga. Olho de gata, dissimulada, uma delícia.
So I imagine people in Brazil are going to flip out.
Oh, they're going to go absolutely
they're gonna go,
I looked up, I know how the Brazilian fans are, and I looked at the lyric video, and people were like, Viva Brazil already, like they're obsessed with it. But it just shows, right? Like, she's like, even Brazil, you're not being left out. I'm taking you on this journey. It's Latin America united forever. Let me do some funk. Let me sing in Portuguese. It's really, really emblematic of what she's trying to do here.
Nice. That's NPR's Ana Maria Sayre, co-host of the Alt Latino podcast. Ana Maria, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Music from Colombia's Carol G. Her new album is called Tropico Queta.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. And we receive support from Clockout Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, who have now switched to their summer hours, open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. Weather tonight, gradually clearing skies, lows around 58, slight chance of rain. Tomorrow, sunny, highs near 83, less winds, 5 to 20 miles per hour.